Welcome to this podcast of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at www.commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. You can also find Inforum on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Welcome to tonight's gathering of Inforum, the division of the Commonwealth Club by and for people in their 20s and 30s with a mission to inspire debate on civic issues. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. I'm Jason Mark, a writer, activist, and farmer here in San Francisco. And tonight we got Tom Zaki from Princeton, New Jersey, here with us. Tom was a student at Princeton University and in his dorm room when he thought that he could launch what has been so far one of the most successful eco-capitalist enterprises in the U.S. today. Tom's first product, in case you guys don't know his story, and there are books here tonight, Revolution in a Bottle. It's a really fun and fascinating book, and I hope you buy a copy of it. And in here, Tom talks about his first product, which is using organic worm poop, vermicomposting, as an organic fertilizer, an idea that he thought up because one of his friends was cultivating a crop that's not yet legal here in California. And now he's got a $15 million company that takes trash from some of the biggest corporations in America and turns them into cash. So is this idea a little half-baked?
Ought to be, right? Yeah. No. Yes, it's always good when things start from pot. For us, I mean, the entire... What blew my mind at the beginning, you know, like the idea of worm poop and vermicompost isn't our idea. It's been around. It's nature's idea, moreover, but it's been around forever. I mean, some of you are, you know, I'm sure have tried it or have done it at home. What blew my mind was this idea of waste, and that we as a group of human beings have created this idea of garbage, and that garbage. This was, you know, I mean, so I'm in the basement of my friend's growing operation in Montreal. Realizing that he's solving his challenge in a very enlightened state, of course, of growing these plants by having fundamentally feeding organic waste to worms. And the thought was, well, wait a minute, you know, garbage doesn't exist in nature in any capacity. Moreover, you know, every ecosystem has a solution for one ecosystem's waste. And that is what started everything for TerraCycle, was the realization that we've created this idea of garbage, I think, honestly, as an illusion almost. We create waste every day by choosing consciously to throw it out. We make it. It's our fault. Every day we make the decision over and over and over to put something in that trash can over there, and we send it to a landfill, and it just sits there forever. But it doesn't really exist as long as we look at it from a different context.
So I thought you had this, there's a great line in Tom's book where he's talking about the sort of, or referring to the idea of biomimicry, which is that we can create economic systems that mirror natural systems. And you say that we need an economy that's more like a tree than like fire. Yeah. So what does that mean? And how do you guys put that into practice at TerraCycle?
And the idea, and that exact quote, actually, you know, the tree versus fire is not even mine. It's Bill McDonough's. He's the one who coined that in his book, Cradle to Cradle. But what's amazing is this idea of biomimicry is, I think, a very powerful one. There's been some really good research, some real seminal writers. I've recently written this book, Revolution in a Bottle, but I'm not a seminal writer in the green space. I'm a fun read. I'm like trash green, you know, than like real solid.
Pun intended.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, it is. I didn't even realize
that. Trash read.
Yeah, but it's not. I'm not going to sit here and say this is, you know, groundbreaking. The people who did do groundbreaking work, Bill McDonough with Cradle to Cradle, Paul Hawken with Natural Capitalism, these green business books, and what they all say repeatedly is that nature has the solution. Nature's figured it out over billions of years, and moreover, nature couldn't exist unless it did figure it out. Because you have to, if we continued, if the human system without evolution existed in the way it does today and continued to grow, we would not be here at some point in time. Now, that may be 1,000 years, 10,000 years, 100,000 years. Either way, any of those increments are small compared to how long life has been around. So we just wouldn't exist because someday, if you've seen like the movie WALL-E, right, they do it really well. They just trash takes over because we choose to throw this stuff out that nature cannot deal with. And so the solution is in nature, and it's obviously staring us in the face this whole time which is do what nature does. And it's not just in the idea of garbage. I mean, that's what I'm obsessed about, is this idea of garbage. But biomimicry and finding solutions in nature exist in everything. And actually, Paul Hawken here in San Francisco is doing a lot of work with another, you know, a couple of other big green movement leaders in trying to create a fund that is all about biomimicry, figuring out, you know, how to fund companies that are sort of copying what nature does.
Yeah, but Tom, I mean, you're being a little too modest, right? Because, I mean, Bill McDonough writes about it, and Paul Hawken writes about it, and, like, you know, I as a journalist can write about it, but you're actually doing it.
True.
Right? So, and you're actually making this happen. Yeah, in a small way in terms of the bigger economy, but actually going out there and creating a company that's, everybody here recycles, but you've coined this term, I don't know if you coined it, but you're actually upcycling. So how does it work? How are you taking the trash from some of America's biggest corporations and making money on that?
It's a great question. There's many ways to segment garbage. Garbage actually is sort of, even before, you know, diving into what it's all about, I think it's important that we step back and appreciate how powerful of an idea garbage really is and how big it really is. And the reason it's important to appreciate it is that we, like any animal, there's no animal out there that I've ever met that likes hanging out in their own feces. I don't know if there's anyone in this room who likes hanging out in their own poop, right? No, I take that as a clear no. And we as human beings, but it's important, you know, it's funny because it's so extreme, but we as human beings have invented devices that move our poop away from us as quickly as possible. Think about the toilet, right? It's a device that is created where, you know, I take a poop and I press the button and that poop goes as far away from me as quickly as possible within the context of engineering, right? Same, and so we consciously don't like thinking about garbage. But everything, absolutely everything, turns into garbage at some point in time. Think about today, you're sitting in your chair, you are wearing clothing, and all that clothing, frankly, way before it's actually totally unusable, you will throw out. Almost 100%. Because of fashion, because it's not in style anymore, because of all sorts of reasons, not because it's covered in holes and it just no longer can give you warmth as a garment. And everything, we're sitting in a room with carpet, with lights, with electronics, with all these things, everything will end up as garbage. There's a neat statistic. Check out, there's this neat video, storyofstuff.com, if you have a chance. It's amazing. And it talks about this, and they have this neat line in there that says, within 6 months, everything you buy, 99% of it will be garbage. And the other 1% may take 10 years, 20 years to become waste, like a house, a car. Everything ends up going there. And we don't really think about it. Humans have created a one-stop solution, which is the big challenge, because in nature, it's not a one-stop solution. Our one-stop solution is send it to a landfill, put it in a dump. In nature, it's not a one-stop solution. You know, a leaf is the waste of a tree, or like a fruit is the waste, you know, like it falls down, it rots. That can be considered the waste of a tree. But some animal, that is the most important thing to that other system. And, you know, whether it's a carcass living, like an animal dying in the forest, or we, again, poop in the forest, or a leaf falls off a tree, a different ecosystem, a different animal, a different organism will go and deal with that. And our issue is we sort of said, well, we're going to send everything to one solution, which is a landfill. But the fact of the matter is if you go waste stream by waste stream by waste stream, that's how you solve garbage. And that may seem like a daunting task. But in reality, there's very, you know, like when you look at every type of garbage that's out there, it's actually not that bad. You know, there's, like as an example, what's the difference between a candy wrapper, a chip bag, a cookie wrapper? It's all wrappers. It's all, you know, one type of basic solution. So, yeah, I mean, Paul Hawken and Bill McDonough coined and really wrote about this and theorized about this in a very enlightened and beautiful way. And what's been amazing is we've really dived into it and tried to create the system of cradle-to-cradle manufacturing where big companies, what happens now is a company like Capri Sun, which produces 4.5 billion drink pouches a year. If you have kids, you may, you know, be aware of this brand. It's a cool brand. And their big problem is drink pouches are not recyclable. And so they pay us substantial amounts of money to create a national program where you as a consumer can go to our website, sign up, and start collecting juice pouches. We even pay the shipping and donate 2 cents for every unit of waste you collect. It's like reverse perpetual Netflix for garbage, if you will. And these big companies are lining up with dollars funding these national, global, in fact, solutions. We're opening up now in Brazil and the UK and all these other countries, and it's the real solution to garbage. Because once you have, and sorry to sort of ramble here, but it's one way to look at waste. Another way is the challenge of separation. You know, one of the big problems with garbage is it's all mixed together. And what I mean by this is, say you walk into a distribution center, or say you just walk into your local store. We'll take a Walmart, because Walmart is sort of a representation of everything in the world that is sold. You can find it at Walmart. So just take that. Imagine if you went into the store and you took every product out of its box, mixed it all together, and put it into a dump right in the middle of the store. The store, it would not be economical to go and put it all back and package it all up again. The store would probably throw it out, because that would be the economical, smart solution. So if you take that, you know, mixing a store together or a distribution center together creates a landfill, the equivalent is true, that a landfill is really just an extremely poorly managed warehouse. It doesn't have racking, it doesn't have inventory control, you don't know what's in it. And if you take that assumption that a landfill is just a poorly managed warehouse, then imagine if you actually could separate out the landfill into every basic raw material that's in a landfill, you'd have something extremely valuable. And that's the big issue, is that we've created this one-stop shop and we mix it all together and we ruin the value that's already inherently there.
So you're a fancy 21st century rag dealer.
Yes. Oh, totally. Yeah.
Yeah.
Except it's to the extreme. Everything becomes a rag, right? So we today, you know, in the last year we collected, I don't know, 50 million juice pouches, 100 million wrappers, you know, half a billion this and a million.
So what do you
that.
Do with 50 million juice pouches?
You sew them together and you make them into pencil cases, backpacks, and you sell them to Target and Walmart, and you sell millions of pencil cases and so on, and it becomes a very big business very quickly.
And especially like in the recession, frugality might be the new trendy thing, and yeah. You guys are just going to surf it.
Well, and the big issue with green is that green is typically, you know, green products are crafty, you know, drab sort of. They're not bright. They're sort of very beige, you know, looking. They're also expensive. I mean, I would say, you know, we're sitting and talking to a group of people that I would consider on the more enlightened side of life. And who here, and just say yes if this is true, every single buying decision where you can make a choice, buy the green choice. 100% of the time.
Busted.
Totally. Now, let me ask this question.
San Francisco. People.
Yeah, and you guys are, man, if it doesn't happen here, we are in a sad situation, right? Yeah, but it's an important point, right?
It's an important point because, I mean, right now, like, you're doing an amazing job, right? And so say are the myriad of organic farmers who are out there now in an industry with 20% growth rate, or say Transfair USA that, you know, certifies fair trade goods. And they're really excited they're 2% of the market. So it's not enough to be 2% of the market. You got to be 10% of the market, or we need to be 30% of the market,
no,
or
we need to be
100% of the
100%
market.
100% of the market.
Right. It's basically what you're saying is anything less than 100% of goods being environmentally sustainable is not going
to
work.
Well, and it drives to a bigger question. And here's my follow-up question to that. It's the same audience. We'll tally the audience again. What if if all green goods and organic, eco-friendly, whatever the label is that's applicable to that product, good, right? We'll just call good. If it didn't cost more, because the big problem is they all cost more. Organic farming costs more, and it legitimately costs more. It's not a coup. It frankly is more expensive to do things the right way than the wrong way. But what if it didn't? What if they were all the same price? Say yes if you would. If that was the case, if you would always buy the green choice when it's available to you.
Yes.
Would anyone not? Anybody? You wouldn't? Sorry? Well, but it is because most people.
So there's different questions here.
Yeah.
In terms of convenience equality of the quality of the
sure.
good.
It comes
but
down
all
to
all things being equal is what you're saying.
Things being equal and convenience being equal, brand being equal, performance being equal. The big issue with green goods that is statistically accurate is that 97% of the American population will not spend a penny more on a green product. But they would if it wasn't a penny more. They want to, but they won't because of price.
Do you think then that price is the number one reason why these things have not scaled up?
Oh, 100%. No, without question. Without even question, it's 100% of the reason. Absolutely.
And you think that other companies can bring their prices down through more upcycling?
Well, here's the problem, right? Take a soda bottle as a simple case study. A soda bottle, the cheapest way to manufacture a soda bottle today is virgin plastic. The next, you know, if you want to go more green, maybe you integrate in a 5%, 10%, 20% recycled plastic, your cost just went up. You go biodegradable, you know, the corn-based PLA plastic, your price just went even higher. What it's saying is the more green you go, the more expensive the product is. And the irony, and this is, you know, so TerraCycle, we package everything in used soda bottles. We're the only company globally to do this, but we package cleaners, fertilizers, pet chemicals, all sorts of things in used soda bottles. And what's so ironic is that when we buy a used soda bottle, we're only paying for the plastic. We're not paying for the shape because a recycling center doesn't value the shape. Frankly, a recycling center destroys the shape to get to their valuable plastic. So we go say, hey, don't spend money destroying those plastic bottles. We'll buy them from you for the weight of the plastic, and we'll just refill them, which is, by definition, it's the cheapest way to package a product and the greenest. And so the problem with the green movement and green products specifically is that if you take incremental baby steps and you make a product more green, and this is not, you know, with farming, it's way more challenging. This doesn't apply to farming because I couldn't educatedly talk about that, but in packaging it does. If you take incremental steps towards more green, then your price will just by definition go up and fewer people by definition will choose to buy your product because price, at least in my opinion, is the number one issue. But if you make it out of garbage, then already you're starting from a price advantage and you can make the greenest products in the world. Like our Capri Sun messenger bag is cheaper than the Hannah Montana messenger bag selling at a local Walmart. And what I love is when people buy that bag and aren't even buying it because they care at all. They don't even know it's used juice pouches. They don't even care about the environment, but they're buying it because it's a cheap, efficient bag.
And if you're Capri Sun, you love that, right? That's like it's like free branding. Yeah. It's just getting out there more.
Look, there's nothing wrong about making companies look good for good things they're doing. It's not, you know, you could say, well, is that greenwashing? It's not. Greenwashing is lying and manipulating, like having an ad, you know, and you're an oil rig and having dolphins swimming near the oil rig. That's greenwashing.
Yeah.
Okay? And people do that. But if you're doing a green thing, even if you're doing other bad things, and I'm not saying any, you know they are or they aren't, but if you're doing a good thing, you should be applauded for that. And we should encourage big companies to feel good about doing the good thing. Because one of the problems in the green movement with people attacking big companies over things they legitimately are doing wrong is they get gun-shy about doing anything right and taking credit for it. Because they're worried about someone accusing them of all the other things they're doing bad, and it sets up. It's not a good stimulus for the company because you want the company to be encouraged to do really good things.
But you make a distinction in the book that I thought I was following, but wasn't really sure. I'm hoping you can help me figure it out. You said there's a difference between environmentally conscious businesses and eco-capitalism.
Sure.
And so, what's that difference?
The difference is where there's companies that. And most companies today fall into this bucket. Companies that, you know, do XYZ, say, you know, take one of our partners, say you're Frito-Lay, and you make chip bags for a living. You're not a green company per se, but you may be inclined to do green things because, you know, of things you want to solve. So Frito-Lay's partnered with us, and we have a major chip bag brigade. But true eco-capitalist companies are the ones that their entire purpose is to function in the green space. And there's very few. That's this funny thing about the green movement is it's so talked about, so overhyped, but there's very few people actually doing it. If you added up all the green companies, even the big ones, you know, Tom's of Maine, Ben & Jerry's, and, you know, Stonyfield Yogurt, you'd have a small conglomerate. It'd be nice, but it wouldn't be a major one. It'd be a small conglomerate if you added them all
together.
Still
an asterisk.
Yeah.
A rounding error for GE.
Well, a rounding, you know, it'd be like a significant business, but when you add up all businesses in the world, it wouldn't be a big deal.
Yeah.
And that's the green movement.
And why do you think more people aren't doing it?
Price. Because right now, especially, you know, in consumer goods, all these examples I gave you, you know, Burt's Bees, Ben & Jerry's, Tom's of Maine, Stonyfield Yogurt, all premium price products, seventh generation,
yeah.
All of them are somewhat of a premium of some degree. And that's the issue.
And that's never going to scale up. What would you say to folks, and again, this is maybe something you might hear more in San Francisco than in other places, who say, you know what, eco-capitalism is not going to work. Capitalism, by definition, is going to destroy the planet. You know, going to quote to you the old Edward Abbey saw about, you know, growth for its own sake is the ideology of the cancer cell, and it's never going to work. But
yes. But growth for the growth's sake is also the ideology of every animal that exists, including a cancer cell, if you consider a cancer cell an animal of some kind or an organism of some kind.
But doesn't won't the market eventually just consume too much?
Unless it balances itself. Unless, you know, one of the reasons it consumes so much is because our population keeps growing. If our population didn't grow, you could only consume so much. Maybe what we would do is instead of, our consumption habits would just move perhaps towards better products that make our lives easier and cheaper, right? But the reason we keep consuming and consuming is because it's a direct correlation to the human population. I mean, you know, human beings only consume so much, but the human population is exploding. At some point, it's going to hit a carrying capacity. You can't have, you know, 100 trillion people on this planet. There's just maybe not even physically enough room for too many people standing side by side, right? There's a physical capacity. So we have to hit that capacity. And I think that capitalism, as long as, you know, the trick is that it's allowed to evolve. What I find is a big problem in capitalism is when you have, like, I personally, and you know, you may agree or disagree with this view, but like, I don't like the idea of government bailouts or government helping business, because business needs to die. If it's not good, if it's not doing, you know, a good job, it needs to go bankrupt. That's the natural. Everything dies at some point. So it's a natural system. There's not any idea, organism, anything that I've ever seen that doesn't die at some point. And that's fine. That's the way life goes. The problem is when you keep, you know, funding oil companies. Why? If we took away all the credits we give to oil companies and all the tax benefits and everything and all the price subsidies, we would be in a green movement much faster in the energy space. Now, we're getting there, but, you know, why prolong it? You know, I think that's the beautiful thing about capitalism is that it sort of figures it out. I mean, I was talking about this with a friend as we were walking here today, and I don't think most people realize that the most powerful vote they make every day is what they buy. It's way more powerful than voting for the president once every 4 years. If, you know, as an example, I bet you this is true. This is a theory. It's not fact. But I bet you if everyone in the world who buys cigarettes stopped buying cigarettes for 6 weeks to 8 weeks, you'd bankrupt every cigarette company in a heartbeat. They would just not be able to survive if they had no
sales.
They
wouldn't have the cash.
No. At that type of volume, not that much time would destroy companies. And so the most important vote everyone makes every day that they're totally, I think, most people not conscious of is what they buy. Because their vote says, I want more of that.
And how do you think you get more people to make the green vote, as it were?
Price. Don't make them conscious about it being green. Don't make green the point. Make it just a better, cheaper product.
Do you see, I asked you, well, why aren't more companies doing this, but why aren't more entrepreneurs doing it? Is there a challenge around capital, just raising the funds that you need to start new businesses? So the old ones die. Okay, let's say the GE, the big oil companies die and something else is going to come up in their place. Is the capital not going in the right direction?
No, it's
Or is it too hard to get the capital?
I wouldn't think that people aren't doing it. I think that the challenge is that it's sort of like, you know, you cut out a tree. This is like, it's all biomimicry at the end of the day. You know, you cut out a tree in the forest, you make light for little seeds to start growing. They will grow. They will figure it out. They will grow, and another tree will take its place. The same thing is in business. You know, if you let the oil companies go bankrupt, you'll have way more startups, way more new companies filling the void. It's not a question of whether there's money available or all these things. It's a question of, is there a need for it? And while the big oil companies in this particular example are around, there is no need for it, or there's less of a need for it. You know, if we stopped having oil tomorrow, everyone would be craving biodiesel. We'd be running everywhere saying, why isn't there a biodiesel pump in my neighborhood? Well, lo and behold, I bet you biodiesel pumps would emerge in a heartbeat everywhere because there's a need. And so, you know, it's just, it's all about allowing that need to come out, I think.
Have you ever thought, in creating your company, Tom was telling me earlier that they've had 100% growth for the last 7 years.
Yeah.
Which is great. Super impressive. Have you ever thought of going public, of trying to go to the next level?
I think TerraCycle at some point will. You know, you need to be a bit bigger than we are. We're still small.
Sure.
You know, 15 million is nice, and for me it sounds really nice, but it's still small. When you get to 50, 100
Mom's
million...
Proud.
Sorry?
Mom's proud.
Yeah, yeah.
15 million.
True, yeah. Yeah, that's right. You haven't really done too much yet. But, you know, when we get to 50 or 100, which may be 3-4 years away, then I think that it does become significant and it's time to go public. And for us, we'd like to go public because it's better than, you know, I think it would be, if TerraCycle really completes its mission, we will become the new recycling globally for everything out there. Because we're collecting, you know, like in Home Depot today, we have collections for saw blades, furnace filters, tape cores. In Best Buy, we're collecting, you know, all sorts of like remote controls and different things. I mean, it's not just juice pouches and chip bags. It's anything and everything. And if we become big enough, we can become the ultimate solution to waste. That's what we're going towards. Hopefully we'll get there.
But would you have any concerns that in going public, then you run the risk? I mean, you mentioned Ben & Jerry's, a wonderful company that when they went public ended up getting bought out by Unilever because of the way that the capital markets work.
Yeah.
Would you be concerned that you would have to make a sacrifice or compromise around your core values in order to get the money you needed to scale up?
See, it's interesting because, you know, before I talked to Ben from Ben Cohen from Ben & Jerry's, I had no problem with being bought by a big company. I still don't, but he felt that they compromised what he was about. But what does it show if you're bought by a big company, even if they butcher everything that you're about? It shows that there's a demand, there's a need for that green innovation, and it'll inspire 20 other people to start companies like Ben & Jerry's and get them as big as Ben & Jerry's. And maybe, you know, it's not a bad thing to sell to a major conglomerate. You know, Ben & Jerry's sold to Unilever, but maybe that's not such a bad thing because maybe Unilever will say, hey, the Ben & Jerry's brand is a really good one. Maybe we should buy more eco brands and go more green. Look at the change you're making, right? So it's not, I don't think it's bad, even if it doesn't completely keep every part of the goal you had.
Do you think those values can percolate up?
Oh, totally. And they do.
That people in Vermont will influence the folks in Switzerland?
They do. I think they absolutely do. I think if you'd be the green activist, quote unquote, right? Because that's sort of a very broad term. I think in general, who hasn't seen how a big company like a Frito-Lay or a Kraft Food works would be very happy walking into their office and seeing what these people think and what they're about, because they're all about going green. And honestly, and I'm not here trying to promote them or anything, but I was very encouraged. Frito-Lay just launched the biodegradable chip bag. That may not sound like a big deal, but they're going to revolutionize the hundreds of billions of wrappers that get made every year by that innovation. They care deeply. They want to do it. The challenge is it's a massive, you know, streamliner going in one direction, and turning it is not easy, especially when it continues to go at a fast pace.
You know, the thing that I kept wondering about in reading the book is if this is such a great idea, and it does. I mean, it's so elegantly simple, right? You get other companies to pay you to take their trash. Why weren't we seeing more of this before? Were they just internalizing the cost of their own waste?
No, you know,
the cost of their own waste,
I've been thinking about this too. Like, we're out there. We have our own TV show or series now, Garbage Moguls. You can tune in on National
Garbage Moguls.
Garbage Moguls, yeah. National Geographic Channel. It's our TerraCycle TV series. Just premiered actually a month ago. It follows us as we take a waste stream, make it into a product, and sell it to a major retailer. It's really fun. But we're out there screaming about this. We're here talking about this, you know, on the radio, and we're not hiding it. There's not a question you can ask me today I won't give you an honest answer to, and, you know, tell you whatever you want to know. And what shocks me is after screaming about this to everybody, no one does it. And I think it's because of the toilet. It's because we don't like garbage. We don't want to think about it. It's not fun. We want to be as far away from it as possible. And because of that, there is no competition. It's a blessing for us in a way from a business perspective because, hey, for me, it's cool because I don't have the competition pressure. I can carefully grow this business and own the world's waste. It's great. But it also would be nicer for the environment if other people started doing it in a big way.
You're sort of the trash mogul.
Yeah, sure. We are the garbage mogul. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
So even in this room here in San Francisco, not that many folks were willing to, nobody actually was willing to go 100% green because of the price question. There's so much enthusiasm around environmental sustainability. I don't think just here in Northern California, but across the country. And yet, again, we're still this asterisk. So how do we go from trend to transformation? And the answer can't just be price again. I mean, you know, how do we actually kind of make the breakthrough
So I can't say price. I'm not allowed to.
I guess you could say price again.
Well, here's the thing. I think it is price, but the question is, how do we solve price?
Yeah.
Right? Because it is the overall answer, and we can't just keep battling against it. And there's a number of solutions in that. The one that we've become experts in is look at what we discard, look at what we throw out, and suddenly there may be a price answer, you know, that comes looming. Garbage, the ultimate solution to price, at least is what I know, is looking at garbage and leveraging it because that has negative price. It's a great way to start. You get paid. I think we're one of the only consumer product companies that have negative raw material costs on a consistent basis in most of our products. I mean, if you look at one of our pencil cases made from juice pouches, half of the pencil cases is negative raw material cost. Frankly, 80% of it is. The only thing new that we have to actually buy is the labor, the thread, and the zipper, right? So that's one way to do it. Now, there is a very deep challenge in that of most, you know, most products are hard to, you know, suddenly move into this matrix. We're lucky because we're building this and we found like the nexus of negative price. But okay, now you're like a guy who, you know, like makes soft drinks for a living, and you're saying, or you're an organic farmer, and you're saying, well, how can I apply this to my world? And it's not always possible. So, you know, one thing, this is where the government, I think, could be positive. I think the government, I'm a diehard liberal, but I also don't like government messing in business. It's this funny sort of oxymoron. With that said, right, because that's like the Republican stance, right? What's interesting is the government can do a lot of good. Why not create a calorie tax and tax calories? I think we'd limit the obesity problem in this country real fast. What if we taxed packaging for its end of life? What if we created these incentives, these barriers for doing wrong? Or doing wrong is maybe not the right term for it, but doing what is not the best for the human society, right? And if we put up these barriers, then we could align it so that the green products didn't actually cost more, even though nothing changed. If you put a tax on carbon, if you put a tax on chemical fertilizers, things like that, then organic farming would suddenly become cost. It'd become great. And then once you add volume, it becomes really good. And that is, I think, a key role for the government to create that ultimate solution, because no matter what we say and how much we preach, we're not going to, I think, change people buying cheap products. We're just not.
So you don't then think there's a way to sort of just bust out of the trash paradigm altogether? And by that, I mean having more durable goods or going back to maybe a deposit system where, you know, you used to, and obviously on some products like Strauss milk here in Northern California, you get a deposit bottle. And you're not really paying for the bottle, you're paying for the milk. And if you take the deposit bottle back, you get a nice chunk of change. Do you think that there's a way to encourage these companies to just, well, produce less quote-unquote trash at the end, to have more durable packaging and more durable goods so that it's not a bazillion Frito-Lay, you know, wrappers ending up in the North Pacific?
Absolutely, if we bought it. Our choice is our vote. It's what we buy. We don't buy. We don't do that.
We don't buy the deposits.
We don't. If we did, that's what we would have. I think, you know, what clearly people should take away and what should share is that is your vote. That is you every day. We, you know, we're sitting in San Francisco and I'm looking straight at a trash can. Why is that trash can here? Right? I mean, if we really were creating our ultimate vote, that wouldn't even be sitting in this room. That would be a negative. That would be a horrible thing to even put into a space, but it's everywhere. And if we chose to buy, you know, all of our products in, like the milk you mentioned, that's all we bought, then that would be the world's number one milk. And that's what it boils down to. We don't do that. No matter how much, you know, it's one of those things like, you know, green marketers intercept people on the street all the time and ask this question. Hey, sir or ma'am, would you buy this green product if, and would you pay a little bit more for it? You have to be, frankly, an asshole to say no. You have to be the most horrible person to say, no, I wouldn't buy that. You know, I'm a Scrooge for the green, right? But then again, that same person who walks like 15 steps down and then they're presented with that choice on the shelf and there's not someone else looking over their shoulder saying, are you going to buy green or not? Or he's going to buy, you know, the normal non-green product. And that's, you know, we have to work within the assumption of the tendency of the human population. We want to do things that are easier for us, that are all, you know, it's primarily how it affects us personally on a short-term basis is what we want to win on.
You know, let's talk a little bit about how you got here, because I think it's a really interesting story. You're kind of a serial entrepreneur, even though you've been with this one company. You were out there making money and hustling and building websites for people when you were in high school.
Yeah.
And you didn't make it out of, you didn't graduate from Princeton because you dropped out to start the company. And again, I mean, I see a lot of people talking about this, but less people making the entrepreneurial jump than perhaps we'd like to scale up into the green economy. Is there just sort of an entrepreneur's DNA personality type that is out there that you see among other people that are starting up these green companies?
You know, it's this question, right? Is it? It's like almost like personality. Like, does personality come from how you're trained or what your environment is, or you know, how does that come? I mean, I've always, and maybe it's because of my background. You know, I was born in Hungary, which was under the Iron Curtain when I was there. I was born in 82, and the Iron Curtain fell in 89. So we lived in Hungary under communism for 4 years, and then Holland, and then Canada. And then what happened is we progressively moved to closer to where you can accomplish the American dream, America, right? And what's amazing about this country that I can tell you is not an American. I'm not an American. I have a Canadian passport or European passport. And I can tell you that here is where you can accomplish the American dream. It's where you can really have an idea and make it big really quickly. Think about the world's biggest, like Walmart, world's biggest company. It's how old? 45 years old as an idea. You know, 45 years ago or 50 years ago, Walmart didn't exist in any capacity of any kind. I mean, look at how quickly you can create scale. And business, I think, is probably one of the more most powerful forces, more powerful than war, than disease, than anything that we know of, natural disaster. You can create more permanent change with business than any other force that is at, you know, a human being's disposal. And especially here in this country, you can, you know, actually, you know, do that. You can, you know, you have every opportunity to do it. And that is, you know, so for me, I saw that clearly. And it's the most exciting thing, you know, to be able to do is to sit and to create and within months see an idea you brainstormed in reality, you know, either on the shelf of Walmart or, you know, on every chip bag in America or whatever, those things becoming real is the most amazing feeling I've ever felt. And it's surprising, you know, because we're in Trenton. It's the third most dangerous city in America. Unfortunately, it's, you know, very black. I live in Princeton, 10 minutes away. I used to live in Trenton until I had bullets fly through my bedroom window. So that is when I sold my house. I couldn't sort of deal with bullets flying. But I ended up moving to Princeton, which is very white, very rich, 10 minutes away from Trenton, very black, very poor. And the people in Trenton, the people in Princeton clearly get the American dream and use it every day, and they are the American dream. They are, you know, that idea. The people in Trenton, who frankly probably would be more of a, you know, a story people would want to talk about and more people want to support, you know, the poor kid from the ghetto making it big, that's a great story. They don't get it. They don't even understand. They don't know that they have that, you know, that this country offers that.
But you've kept your, correct, your company's based in Trenton, your warehouse is there,
totally,
and some of your, and many of your employees live in Trenton.
Yeah.
Was that, and why did you make that decision?
You don't hold it against me, but the honest answer is because it's cheap. It's price.
Price.
Oh, yeah. You can buy, like, I mean, the cheapest real estate in America is in Camden and Trenton. They both happen to be in New Jersey because New Jersey, so, you know, it's New Jersey, right? But Camden and Trenton, the first and third most dangerous cities in America, are the cheapest places to buy things by definition, buildings and people. They're, you know, one of the big issues with, and I can only concisely give you my theory of Trenton in a crude way, so don't hold this against me, but it's you know, Trenton exists because I think, in general, white people are scared of black people, or white rich people are scared of black poor people. People don't like going there. There's no public transportation because why, you know, tax dollars aren't doing that. Oh, and, you know, the government brings in a lot of government jobs. There's a huge amount of government jobs in Trenton, but they say two things that are really brutal. If you have a drug record or you have a criminal background, you can't get the government job. Well, you can't live and be born in Trenton and live there for until you're 20 without one of those two things. You're going to smoke some pot. You're going to deal some heroin. You just, that's what life is like in a city like that. And so it, you know, we've created these sort of constructs in this way. So what we say is, look, of course we're going to locate in these cities because it's the best deal in town. It's the best deal in America. The only better deal than Trenton in America is Mexico or China.
This brings up the much talked about question, especially here in the Bay Area, since Van Jones is based here, about the green collar economy and how you ensure that this transition to an ecologically sustainable economy is also benefiting the folks you're talking about in Trenton, because you're not going to get to 100% if it's just for rich white folks in Princeton, New Jersey.
You're not.
And in San Francisco. And so how do you make that, how do you ensure that this green economy, that this ecologically sustainable economy involves benefit, has stakeholders from throughout the society, regardless of income, race, ethnicity, et cetera?
You do two things. So if you're a consumer, how can you today, when you're leaving this, support this sort of initiative is by supporting companies and buying. It's so funny because the key message that I've realized in our conversation today, and it wasn't planned, I wasn't coming in with this agenda, was two things. Your vote is what you buy, and price is the key determinator of what you buy, right? Those have been the two key sort of recurring thoughts that have come up amongst our conversation here. And the way you as a listener, as a person here in the audience today can deal with this is by consciously supporting companies that do that. What companies and business leaders, if you're a business leader or you're thinking of becoming a business leader, what you should consider is that the best deal in town is in the inner city. Don't do it because you care about those people. Don't do it for all those reasons. Do it because it's the best deal in town from a price perspective. And then you're really creating big change. And, the best deal in town in San Francisco is Stockton. It's great. And there's an example of a town that's not doing all, it's more depressed. The best deal in town, great deals are Pittsburgh, Detroit, Buffalo, Camden, Trenton.
But I guess what's jamming me up here, if it's the same logic around relentless price cutting that many people would say is the reason why we've got so many environmental negative externalities in the economy, isn't that just going to mimic itself even in the green economy? See what I'm saying? I mean, if you're starting from the, I guess, just for sake of argument, is the original sin of lowest price always wins, aren't you going to have a hard time really making this transition in a way? Because you're not going to have enough people who are going to want to make the investments in Trenton, or people who are going to want to make the investments in West Oakland or East Oakland to set up things there, if that's their only motivator.
True. I think that this is where, in the broader question of all this, is where the government has a key role. The government is what we as a people have created to help do the right thing when the right thing may be not the, it's a hard way to say it, but that the right thing may be not the right thing from an individual perspective. It's what is best for all of us at once is what the government is here to do, I think, right? They're here to protect all of humanity no matter what, right? And that's where the government needs to create help. That's where the government needs to tax and say, if you create a chemical product, then you should pay a burden for it. You create a product that is non-recyclable, you should pay a burden for it to deal with it. Or on the flip side, if you're going to locate in, inner cities, you should, the government should help you do that. Maybe cover some of the wages. There is a role for the government here. I don't believe that, the government should set the constraints, should create the rules. That's the point of laws, right? They say, don't do this and do that, And so that's, I think, a really important set is to create all these rules. And the rules right now around business are not fully baked because business, the way manufacturing has existed today is not that old. It's 50 years old is the way we mass manufacture. So we need to create all these rules. There should be a life cycle tax for everything. And everyone should be responsible. And some countries, European countries, do these extremely well, where they're starting to create. France, I heard, is now forcing products soon to put the carbon impact of their product on every product that is made in France.
You don't say you generated a half ton of carbon in the make, in the buying of this Frito-Lay bag.
Yes. Now, where they should really go, the next step is then that should be a tax. And, Frito-Lay, if it takes X to do that, should have to put some money into the offsetting that carbon into a pool of some kind. It may be some company that is actually doing the offsetting, planting trees or whatever they do is benefiting from that. That is the role of government, I think, in business.
Right.
Is to
create
those rules.
If men were angels, they wouldn't need government, I think
right.
James Madison said. Yeah. So, and so you think some of the rules that should be out there are just around transparency, or it should also be around the life cycle of the product? What's going to, it shouldn't just be telling the consumer, well, you created
No. I think telling the consumer is by far the first step. The real step is creating a true, because telling the consumer creates a burden, but it creates a psychological burden. The marketing folks are the ones that are going to be concerned about that. The marketing department at a Unilever or at a Procter & Gamble will be affected and will create change because of that thing that is now plastered over their product. They don't want to become the worst, you know, so they'll become better. But the real change is when you put dollars on the table, is when it's not just put it on the product, but say for every unit of carbon you emit, you spend a buck. That creates change so fast.
So this has been a really full conversation, but we'd love to hear what other people think. So if you've got any comments, questions, shorter polemics, we'd love to hear them. And Caroline's going to pass around a wireless mic, and if you could speak into that, that'd be much appreciated.
I'd like to make one comment and then ask you a question. The comment is that I lived in Massachusetts until recently, and there the waste streams are segregated. And in fact, I think it's a state law. So this is not something that can't be done in the more liberal-thinking states. My question is, you talk mostly about business models and the role of the government and all that, but I'm really curious if you would give us a list of the kinds of products you make out of waste. You told us about the pencil case.
Yes.
Could you tell us about 10 or 15 others that you make?
Sure. Let me rattle some off for you here. We make shower curtains out of bare naked granola bags. We make kites out of Oreo wrappers. We make journals out of Frito-Lay chip bags. We make fertilizer out of worm poop and seed starters. We make rain barrels out of wine barrels. We make pots out of e-waste. We melt chip bags down and make electronic components and speakers. We have a line of cleaners, pet chemicals. We take dog food bags and turn them into leashes and you know, pet rain jackets. And I can go on and on. You tell me when to stop. But at the end of the day, what we've realized is that there's no waste that cannot be made into a product, and there's no product that can't be made from waste. And, you know, fire logs from wax cardboard. Wax cardboard is not recyclable, and you compress it, you have one of the best fire logs that exist. And I could go on for the next 15 minutes giving you example by example by example, but we've never run into a waste stream. Take a, you know, like an antiperspirant stick, like a degree antiperspirant stick. What if you took out the antiperspirant and put it in the gigantic eraser? You could still take advantage of the little clicky mechanism that moves the stuff up, right? Like an anti, you know? You'll see that in the marketplace really soon. Or we're working with Stonyfield Yogurt and soon one of the biggest yogurt companies. And, you know, I presume you've probably bought plants at a nursery in your time here on the planet. And that those nursery pots are not recyclable easily. They're probably not really collectible in most communities, even though it's a recyclable type of plastic. You're going to see a huge number of plants at major retailers packaged, literally, in yogurt cups. And all we do is put a hole in the bottom and sell the yogurt cup to a nursery and do that in millions of yogurt cups at a time. And so every waste has a solution at the end of the day, whether you sew together juice pouches and make a pencil case or a backpack or a lunchbox or an apron, you know, whatever it may be. We have, it's infinite, the range. But, you know, today it's hundreds of products.
I find that very interesting. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Tom, what was the hardest one to solve? Like, what was the product where a company came to you and said, we've got this junk, and you guys, it took you like 3 weeks to figure out the killer app on that one?
You know, the hard ones are what, and I'll give another sort of nod here to Bill McDonough, is what Bill in Cradle to Cradle called a monstrous hybrid. Those are the hardest because, and I'll give you an example of a monstrous hybrid. A monstrous hybrid is by definition a product that is comprised of many different materials, such as a Tosimo coffee cartridge. Is aluminum, plastic, paper, and coffee. A furnace filter, everyone here probably who has a house or, you know, lives in an apartment, contributes to the furnace filter problem. If you have a furnace, most people do. It's metal with fabric that's covered in puts and, you know, sticky cardboard is what it made up. So those are the hard ones. Or pens. Take a pen, a pencil, a shaving, you know, like what you shave with, the actual, you know, not just the blade, but the handle of a shaver, like a Gillette shaver or something. Those are hybrids, and they're made of all sorts of different polymers. So what we have to do is separate out the polymers, separate it all out to be able to deal with it. And it's very doable. Or a car seat, a baby car seat, fabric, plastics, you know, metals all together. Those are the hard ones. The easy ones are the ones that are, you know, relatively consistent materials.
Oh, you mentioned earlier about your expansion to Brazil.
Yes.
I'm curious to know more about that, and particularly your views around opportunities in emerging markets and developing world. There's not a shortage of labor or waste. In fact, in many cases, they're taking waste from the developed world.
It's interesting, and so two pieces. I'll touch on Brazil in a moment, but you touch on something really fascinating, the factor of value of waste. And, you know, take this just for, you know, it's hard to be, it's easier to be crude to be succinct here. So, you know, in certain countries, Jakarta, you know, and a whole number of third world countries, people find a great economy in digging through landfills. Now it's the poorest of the poor, but they can live and sustain themselves by living in a landfill and finding value from the landfill. And we could do the same here, but frankly, no one's really motivated to dig through a landfill because there's minimum wage, there's welfare, there's better ways to live than digging through a landfill. But what's interesting is as we progress into third world markets, what we expect to see is more collection than consumption. So we would collect more waste than we would necessarily sell back in finished products. Now we may, you know, the waste we collect in Brazil, if we collect more than the Brazilian market can handle, although the Brazilian market is relatively developed, but if we have a less developed market, we may collect more and move it into a more developed market. In Brazil specifically, our office will be in Sao Paulo. We're actually just setting that up as we speak. And the program, TerraCycle, launches officially in a month, nationally in Walmart, and in partnership with Frito-Lay, which is Elma Chips in Brazil, and Walmart, where they're funding us to collect chip bags all across Brazil. And what's unique is that instead of collecting them in schools, like in America, they're being collected in favelas and all sorts of really poor areas. It's a unique twist that is beautiful to the whole system. And it's this ironic launch. You know, it's Frito-Lay and Walmart, two massive global conglomerate, you know, companies that are really helping and creating this amazing win. And if Brazil goes well, which I'm sure it will, we're also, you know, we'll launch with more brands. And Walmart is even putting now chip bag collections, actual physical units, in the first, like in 30 days in Brazil, you'll see physical chip bag collection units at a number of Walmarts in Brazil that are all these TerraCycle chip bag collection stations. And it's truly amazing to see these big companies embracing it because they're the ones doing it. We're facilitating, but like we have two people on the ground in Brazil. We're not the ones really, you know, making the big commitments. It's Walmart and Frito-Lay, you know, doing it, which is great. And if Brazil works, you know, Argentina, Venezuela, Chile, and all the small countries as well will join in real quick. I mean, we're ready to go. It's just we'll do a case study there first.
Any other questions, comments, observations?
I had a question about your business operations. What are the top two or three challenges that you're facing?
You know, we don't really have competition, but what is our biggest challenge is because of our growth. You know, I mean, in a company that doubles in size every year, you're walking into a brand new operation every year because it's gotten just so much bigger. And so our biggest issue and the biggest thing we work around is execution. Getting big companies to say yes is easy. Getting on the shelf of Walmart, ironically, is easy. What's important is making sure you deliver high-quality product and you make sure you know, do your service very well. That's our biggest issue, is executing really, really well all the time, because that's our only challenge. There's nothing else in our way. Just do your job well. And the problem of doing your job well in a situation where the company is twice as big every year is that it's growing so fast. Like, our customer service department is perpetually hiring. Because we hire someone and we catch up to where we were and then suddenly again we're behind. You know, so that's the issue, is managing the growth and executing under the pressure of extreme growth. That's pretty much it. Everything else is simple. Coming up with these ideas, I mean, nothing I mentioned today, you know, you asked me to list off some products, nothing is rocket science. Anyone in this room could come up with these with just putting, if we put the waste in the floor, like if I just put 1,000, actually, I'd love to sort of try this, if it's okay. Maybe hard to, because of the format of the mic, but maybe it would be interesting. Can I try an experiment here? Sorry, in advance. What I'd like to say is, let's pick a waste stream, and we're going to visualize it in front of us. Let's pick one that we actually need help with. Let's say toothbrushes, okay? Dirty, used toothbrushes. There's a big pile of them in the front, and I'd like to, maybe we can quickly pass the mic around the circle, and everyone can throw out really quickly. If you don't have an idea, just pass the mic to the next person. If you have an idea, just quickly throw it out. What can we do with toothbrushes? So, Yuret, go for it.
This is a collective brainstorm.
Okay.
Speak into the mic, please.
Go quick and go around.
So you have two parts to it. So you melt the plastic down, you can do anything you want with that. So
true.
That's easy.
Yeah.
And then the bristles, you know, dental floss is one. You could tie it all together and make rope. You could
sure. Like that. Okay.
I can't imagine doing anything with the dirty bristles, but I'd chop off the handles and use the handles for something, you figure out.
I mean, there are many things you can do with brushes, so I mean, that's what everybody does, right? You use them for something else than brushing teeth.
Okay. Brushing something else. Yeah?
Yes, such as, I right now at home, I have a problem of channels in my sliding windows that are dirty. And they need to be cleaned, and I have lots of old toothbrushes, but the handle should be bent in order to get in.
So we can melt them and bend them to be exactly the tool you need.
Exactly.
There you go.
And you could, right. You could even cock the brushes a little bit to make them cover a wider strip.
Brilliant. Actually, if they're used in this, and the brushes are sort of splayed out, it may actually help, right?
Yes.
There you go.
As a reminder to our audience, this program is being presented by the Commonwealth Clubs and Forum. If you're just tuning in, you're probably awfully confused. And tonight we're hosting Tom Zaki, author of Revolution in a Bottle and co-founder and CEO of TerraCycle, which recycles trash. And the question is, if you had a pile of toothbrushes, millions of them, used dirty toothbrushes, how would you recycle them into another kind of usable product? And we've got a few more ideas here, and then we're going to hear actually what TerraCycle did with it.
Yeah, absolutely. So please, sir.
How about toys? Well, I would vote for the brush cleaner.
Great.
As well.
A photo frame. Just line them up, four of them.
The former administration probably could have come up with some interrogation techniques with them. But let's see. I like the cleaning idea and the recycling and forming them to other things also. Earrings.
Nice.
My first thought was industrial scrubbing. There's a lot of things out there that are a lot dirtier than teeth.
Maybe reusing the handles for new toothbrushes?
Maybe in archaeology, dusting fossils or whatever.
Well, I could think it was maybe combining them together to get a really wide multicolored surface.
You know, it's funny you say that. So if it's great too, because you're the last person in the circle to say, you know, to be there. What we're going to end up doing with them is two things: cut off the bristles, you know, clean them so that they're not gunky, and then laminate them to a mat, and suddenly it's a welcome mat that you can scrub your shoes on, and it's made from 1,000 brush heads, and the handle itself, melting it down is a huge solution to it, but also drilling a hole in it, and suddenly you make it into a pen, and you just put in a pen ink, you know, well into it, and it becomes a really cool pen, and it's actually quite ergonomic, because the brush companies have already spent millions of dollars figuring out how you hold a brush, and it's good in your hand. The point is, I just threw out a random waste stream, and I picked one that is not easy, and within, 3 minutes, 4 minutes, we came up with probably 10 to 20 ideas that are actually quite good ideas, you know, and what if we had 10 more minutes? I mean, the point is, that's not the hard part. It's just saying, we're not going to throw the toothbrush out, and we're actually going to have this conversation about the toothbrush, and someone's going to get around dealing with it because it's going to make them a bunch of money.
So in a sense, our most important renewable resource is creativity. It's just actually brainstorming the way out of here.
Right. And I'm going to do my one plug of the day, or my one sort of thing I ask everyone to consider, is we want to create the encyclopedia of waste, of upcycling. And here's the deal. Send us a email. And my personal email is tom@terracycle.net. You can email me an idea, and we'll forward it internally in our team. And the idea has to be a way to upcycle garbage, any garbage, into a product. We will, and you have to trust us here, we will review and deem whether it's a unique idea. If it's available in any way on the internet, if there's something close to it on the internet, or we've already thought about it internally, it's not unique. And we will come back to you within, say, 6 weeks or so after review and tell you if it's unique or not. If it's unique, and if we, at some point, 20 years from now, make it into a product, you will get a royalty up to a cap of $20,000 on that product. And what we want to do is ask you to send us all these ideas of products made from waste so we can create the encyclopedia of upcycling. And if you send us something truly unique, then you could also make some money on it, which could be really interesting. It could be an elementary school. It could be a university design studio. It could be just you at home. But please, send it to us, and we will we'll take it very seriously, and we will, if it's, you know, economically feasible, then we will make it, because why not? We'll make money on it, and we'll pay you. And at the end of the day, you know, the big win here is not necessarily the $20,000, but that's pretty cool. It's that if you send us an idea that's really groundbreaking, then we will potentially channel a bunch of garbage into that product instead of sending it to a landfill. So we'd love for you to participate, and that's my one ask today.
I saw one other question over here. Somebody had a question or a comment.
So in your Capri Sun example, why does Capri Sun pay you to collect them, and then who makes the pencil cases? You make the pencil cases, but Capri Sun
No, it's a good... Let me give you the whole sort of story here. Capri Sun covers the following costs. They cover all the costs of TerraCycle running the collection program, the shipping, the donation, the customer service, all those bits and pieces. They cover that because they want to produce a solution to the drink pouch. They don't want these drink pouches to all end up in a landfill. And what they can do is they can give the consumer a choice. I think it's a really great act. There's actually nothing negative. The consumer wins because they make money by doing the right thing and they get educated. What's great is, you know, there are right now 17,000 elementary schools across America collecting juice pouches. What's great about that is that's teaching 17,000 kids that you don't have to throw out the juice pouch. It's a great behavior to teach at that age. And you know, everything you're doing there is very positive. So they're paying because they want to do that, and they want to be seen as green. They want people to feel good about it. I mean, there is a clear marketing benefit to this. They want to be written up in articles saying they're doing the right thing, and there's nothing wrong with that, but that's why they're doing it. When the pouch comes to us, TerraCycle, what we do is we check it in, we clean it. That's what we do in Trenton. We don't own the sewing factories. We don't sew in America. We sew in Mexico or in El Salvador or in, you know, a global manufacturing process because, you know, the honest truth is you can't sew in America. It's impossible. There isn't a talent base anymore because there's no, you know, no one here trains to be a sewer like they do in China or in India. And also you can't afford it. So we manufacture in really great factories outside the U.S., and it's just the reality of business in a way. You know, you can't. One thing we've realized is that you can't win on every front. It's not possible because you will collapse. So we pick the battles and pick the wars.
Let's do one more question before we end here this evening.
I guess I'm just wondering, do you consider yourselves a green business? Like, you take all these products and you do reuse them, but what happens when you break products down that have chemicals in them? Or what happens if you aren't accounting for the energy use in whatever your factories are, whatever, you know, factories you're paying to do the work for you? So I'm wondering, how green are you?
Great question. So Here's the first thing. I mean, there's a number of factors here to answer in what you asked, but let me try to tackle a couple of them. First, let's compare, and we've done this, carbon analysis, of making a pencil case in China out of cotton versus making a pencil case, say, even in China, out of juice pouches that you ship from America to China. We're taking the most extreme case, right? That's not how we do it today. We make them in Mexico, but let's just take that case. That's what we evaluated. The biggest carbon impact of making a pencil case, say a cotton pencil case, is not the shipping it over the world. That's not the issue. The issue is you have to have a cotton farm. You have to grow the cotton. You have to extract the cotton. You have to refine the cotton. You have to weave the cotton. You have to bleach it, dye it. You have to go through all these processes to get to a cotton that can actually be sewn and is a fabric. What's great is a juice pouch already has done all that, and you don't have to do anything. You don't have to extract anything from the planet. The biggest issue with products and the biggest carbon impact of a product is not the shipping. It's a misconception, frankly. And the reason we all think shipping is the big deal is because carbon equals cars, and we've become very educated about carbon and cars, and it's very accurate. You know, we've moved away from the SUV. It's fantastic. It's great. But in a product perspective, you know, I'm holding a drink here. This product or any product that I hold in my hand, it's not the shipping that's the problem. It's extracting all the raw materials from the earth to make this product. So this is a beer. You have to grow barley. You have to, you know, do all those different things to it, and you have to get the glass, you have to go through sand, you have to, you know, there's so much process in making this beer. Shipping it to my endpoint is not the real issue. So by making products out of waste, it's by far, without question, incredibly green compared to making them out of virgin materials, or even if you compare recycled materials, because recycled materials require a meltdown and a melt up. And when the product is finished, one rule we have is, let's say you have a Capri Sun backpack made from, say, 50 juice pouches. You can take that backpack, put it, when you're done with it, say, every product has an end of life. Say you're not into Capri Sun next year and you want to get rid of it and now you want to move on to a SpongeBob backpack, right? Okay, fine. You put the Capri Sun backpack into the Capri Sun collection program, which you can sign up for free on our website. And we will donate 2 cents for every juice pouch in that backpack back to you again, and we will use it for something else. And it goes on and on forever as long as the consumer chooses. So we're as green as the consumer chooses. It all boils down to what you want. I don't exist. TerraCycle doesn't exist if you don't go to the website and start collecting garbage, and it definitely doesn't exist if you don't go to Walmart and buy our Capri Sun backpack. It's your choice.
Everyone, thank you so much for joining us tonight for this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club. Let's give a hand to Tom Zaki for coming here tonight.
Thank you.
And talking with us. And with that, this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.